Hey, podcast listeners. Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/adfreenews. That's amazon.com/adfreenews to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Anton Savage Show. On News Talk.
There's new autobiography out entitled In One Ear, Cocteau Twins, Ivor, Raymond and Me. And it is the story of a musical career, a music publishing career and a weird response to a cancer diagnosis from a man who, it turns out, is a huge Phil Collins fan, that being Simon Raymond. Simon, good morning.
Hi, Anton. Very nice to talk to you.
How are you? And I mean that both generally as an amenity, but also really, how are you?
I am really, really well. Yeah, a book's coming out in a few days. So, you know, full of anticipation for how that goes down.
And,
but all well.
Not wishing to pry, how is your tumour?
Well, my tumour is just sort of as it has been for some time. It's an acoustic neuroma, and it's a very slow growing tumour. It hasn't really troubled me, you know, in living my life, as it were, since I had the diagnosis when I was 40. I'm now 62. So, yeah, I had some brilliant advice. I had two pieces of advice when I was first diagnosed with it. One, which was lay on this table and I'm going to get my big circular drawer out and drill it into your head and take it out about 5 minutes after I'd found out I had a tumor. And, you know, not strangely, I refused the diagnosis then. And I said I needed some time to think about it. And thankfully got a different opinion from a different doctor a couple of weeks later, which gave me a whole different perspective on the tumor and what I could do. So I'm completely deaf in my right ear. So that ain't ever coming back, whether I had it out or not. So what do? You know, you just, like anyone who sort of gets a bit of bad news about these things, you just have to kind of get on with your life, right?
Oh, well, I love the way you recount it in the book, because the doctor who gives you the option of let me drill into your skull, he pitches it as, you know, I have a golf game tomorrow morning, but I'm around this afternoon, so let's lash after it. I didn't think brain surgery was done on that kind of a whim.
Yeah, it was like, you don't know how lucky you are that I'm actually in the hospital at this moment. This was very much the thing, whereas I'm still reeling from the news, because I literally just walked out from staring at my tumor on an X-ray panel on the wall, you know, and I'm still like, what the heck? I'm glad I was such a coward that I didn't go down that road.
Well, I'm glad. I mean, I'm sorry that you have lost the hearing in the ear, but it is great that 20 odd years on, the guy who said, nah, don't worry about it too much, turned out to be correct and that you are well and healthy.
Oh, yes. I mean, I still mail with him, actually. He you know, as I said in the book, he was such a lovely, kind, wise man. You know, even from the moment I walked in and saw him in his office at the Royal Marsden, I was like, oh, this guy's lovely. And I sort of trusted him immediately, whereas the other guy just, I don't know, he, as I said in the book, he reminded me a bit of, you know, Marathon Man.
the character is in that. Is it safe?
Yes, exactly.
Now, while I'm prying with personal questions, given all of the trouble that your father went to install it into your surname, why do you not pronounce your E?
Yeah, well, if my mum was still alive, she'd be calling me up going, it's Raymond. You know, she liked it. She liked the E. She thought it made her sound posh. My brother and I have always been Raymond. I don't know why. It's probably a vanity thing. It just, I don't know, sounds less... I don't know. Posh is probably the word.
Oh, so, I don't know. There's a certain edgy punk thing about being a Ramond, isn't there? It's edging towards the Ramones. No?
I don't know. Honestly, I get both, so I've kind of gotten used to it. But when I'm asked what I say Raymond, just because it just rolls off the tongue a bit easier. But it's laziness, probably.
The book covers late 70s, early 80s punk. It covers Cocteau Twins and all of the success that went with that. It covers publishing and a whole load of your personal life. One of the things in it that I found most intriguing was the way you write the relationship with your father, because you describe it as sort of distant, but you write about him with a great sweetness and affection.
Yeah, that's true. And I always had that for him. And I think growing up, even though he was a distant parent, and it wasn't like we were friends. I mean, you know, I'm friends with my kids. This is a completely different generation. Now, culturally, I think parents back in the 60s and 70s, you know, they weren't hanging out with their kids and high-fiving them. It just wasn't like that. So it was a very sort of traditional father-son relationship. But because he wasn't around very much, I just didn't know him. And I've spent very little time with him because of his work and the fact that, you know, they sent me away to boarding school. And then as soon as I came out of school, I was in a band off traveling around the world myself. So it was only really when I started the book that I was, probably started a little bit before that. Those who follow my label, Bella Union, might know that I put out a couple of double albums of his work a few years back when I really started to get deep into what he did. And for your listeners who are wondering who the hell is this Ivor Raymond guy, he was a string arranger and a songwriter and a musician from the 60s. He co-wrote I Only Want to Be With You for Dusty Springfield, basically launched her career as a solo artist. And then he went on to do string arrangements for the Walker Brothers, David Bowie, Billy Fury. He worked on Joe Meek's records. He worked with Ian Dury. He just did loads of things, which I kind of knew about when I was growing up. But the finer detail and the sort of deep dive that I did later in life into his catalogue was what really kind of opened my eyes to his work. And then discovering these transcripts, tapes that he made before he died with my mum about his life, his growing up. And his career, that really, you know, really helped me an awful lot trying to understand him.
You have this piece where you describe the work that he did on cruise ships, Queen Mary, I think it was, if I have that right.
Yeah.
Directly after the Second World War, coming from rationing and struggles after in post-war Britain to the most extraordinary excess that it's possible to have, and how he indulged in it, and the exposure to some of the greats of jazz at the time. It must have been an interesting revelation to you to see him live that life, that shift.
Oh, sure, because I literally had no idea about that. You know, I don't know why he never told me, because it surely is it's a great dinner party story. Maybe I just never went to any of the dinner parties. The stuff, the extravagance of that period just after the war, as you say, on the ship alone, the food that they were getting, they couldn't believe it. And then obviously they get to New York. New York's an absolutely wild place at that time. The food and the drink and the bars and the cafes are just quite a way elevated from what he was used to in London. So, yeah, I think the traveling was amazing for him. And then, of course, I'm looking back at my own career where, you know, I got to go to New York when I'm in my early 20s with my band. And going back again more recently, I sort of go to the places that I knew he was at just to try and, you know, stop for a moment and think about his journey. Helps me get a little bit closer to him, although, you know, it's a forlorn hope, really.
One of the most entertaining pieces in the book about your travels is your experience of discovering that you were Metallica's favourite band.
Yeah, I mean, wonders never cease. Our booking agent was involved in the setting up of Lollapalooza, which is still a massive big kind of rock festival that tours around the US. And I think Metallica were like the headline band on this tour in the 90s. And our agent was like, the guitarist of Metallica, Kirk Hammett, is a massive fan. He'd love you to come and play on all the shows at Lollapalooza. And we just didn't fancy it. Anton, if I'm honest, you know, I don't know why. Maybe snobbery, maybe thinking that our music was just never going to translate in those kind of arenas. But it was just relentless conversations. And you must do it. He really wants you to do it. We're like, no, it's not going to be the right thing for us. Come on, just at least do one. So we succumbed and we did the opening night of Lollapalooza in Kansas City. And well, your listeners, if they buy the book, they'll understand what happened. But it wasn't good.
I love the fact, though, that it begins with you being introduced by Metallica as, ladies and gentlemen, our favorite band.
Yeah, and that was as good as it got, because shortly after that we were not bottled off, because they didn't have bottles, but we were being mud pied off.
When they're actually digging up the ground to fling it at you, that's really disliking what you're putting out there.
Oh yeah, no, one really big pie hit Elizabeth directly between the eyes, and at that point she was like, goodbye. And that was the end of us, and I think we barely made 20 minutes of our set. So having gone from the euphoria of walking out to 40,000 people chanting our names, it didn't end so great.
Oh, but the anecdote, Simon, the anecdote. What is it? Tragedies often become comedies, just a matter of timing and distance. Now, the other thing in this, in the way that you write about stuff, is there is a very sort of relaxed, sanguine, even view of some pretty extreme events. That being one. My other favourite is the way that you write about the Japanese gentleman who on stage drove a bulldozer through the wall of a gig and had to be stopped flinging a petrol bomb into the crowd. But you write about it like, you know, it was another Tuesday. Was punk that good in the late 70s, early 80s?
It is a great story. And I think it just made me, when I was in Japan, obviously I'm kind of bowled over by the culture. The very first time I was there, it was extraordinary, so different to everything I'd been used to growing up. And I think this is sort of pre-internet. This is it's probably not pre-mobile. I mean, maybe it's pre-mobile phones, but it's pre-understanding anything about the rest of the world as a, whatever I was, 21-year-old guy. So finding all this stuff out about the different culture was really eye-opening for me and taught me an awful lot. But yes, that particular incident where the guy drove a bulldozer into the club, it was his way of, I don't know, being as punk as you could get. But
I think he achieved it.
Yeah, it could have ended very badly. I think the Molotov cocktail was kind of grabbed out of his hand at the last minute, thankfully.
Now, to go back to where we started in all of this, when we look at singers who you should like and you shouldn't like, Phil Collins did nothing to you. John Lydon told you to your face to F off, and yet you still write about him like he is a god. Phil Collins gets awful abuse. Would you not soften your view of him slightly in the years since?
Yes, I think I'm feeling bad about that in the last couple of weeks, because I've met a couple of people who are like, oh, you know, I went on a podcast with Nikki Chapman, lovely lady, and we were talking about experiences, and she was talking about people she'd worked with, and she went, oh, you know, I did this, and I worked with, you know, Jerry from the Spice Girls, and oh, Phil Collins, he's so lovely. Do you know Phil, Simon? And I was like, no, I don't know him. But I haven't written very favourably about him.
Yes, avoid chapter four in my autobiography.
I do have some guilt about that now. I'm sure he's an absolutely lovely bloke.
Congratulations on the autobiography. I hope it sells like hotcakes. The title of it is In One Ear, Cocteau Twins, Ivor Raymond and Me. And in honour of your mother, Simon, I'll give you the official out. Simon Raymond, thank you so much.
Thank you, Anton. Lovely to talk to you.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.